Okay, let me begin by reminding everybody of the basic problem that we're concerned with in this course. This is the great problem of war and peace. How do you understand war in international politics? And we're trying to get at that issue by examining a very important set of arguments. This is the idea that war is not to be understood as the product of aggression, not to be understood in moral terms, product of human evil or whatever. War is to be understood as a product of the system of sovereign states, of what's called the international anarchy, of the fact that there is no overarching authority that regulates international politics. That there's the words of John Mearsheim, one of the premier neorealist theorists. There's no 911 number that states can call if they get into trouble. They have to take care of themselves. They live so close to the margin that they can't afford not to think in terms of what they have to do in order to provide for their security. And the way that countries can make themselves secure is by getting more power. The power is basically a relative concept. It's not like wealth, which is to be understood in kind of absolute terms. You get power, but that means that your adversary has less of it. So this introduces this competitive element into the heart of international politics. Everyone is trying for a bigger slice of the pie, but not everyone can have a bigger slice of the pie. This forces states into conflict with each other. You don't need aggressors to have wars. You know, aggressors may cause wars, but that's not necessary. You know, that's the argument that Waltz makes in that piece that you read last week. And this is an argument that's made not just by realists, but by the other great group of writers on international affairs, the liberals. The liberals basically say, yeah, that's correct. In a world of sovereign states, you have big trouble. You know, this is a world that engenders conflict, engenders war. But there are solutions. You could create the equivalent of supranational authority. You can create these international institutions. It won't solve all these problems 100%, but it reduces their severity. It blunts the harsh edges of international politics. But note that the whole analysis is rooted in the same diagnosis of how an anarchic system works, of what happens when there's no overarching authority to regulate the policies. So this is a very important argument. It's like, you want to understand war? It's the structure that's to be blamed. It's the system that's to be blamed. Countries may not want to pursue aggressive policies, but they kind of have to, because they're pushed forward by the basic structure of the system. They may be interested only in their own security, but the way to provide for their own security is by getting more power, and that's what pushes them into conflict with each other. Right? So that argument, a very important argument, that's our focal point. That serves to focus the analysis of the historical issues. Okay. And what about the lecture today? The lecture today, we're dealing with an important period in the history of the 19th century. In fact, a pivotal period. I call the lecture a period of transition because it's the pivot. It marks the transition from one system to another. Because when you look at the 19th century, you're struck by the fact that the first half of the century and the second half of the century are very, very different from each other. But more precisely, the period from Vienna to the revolutions of 1848, that period from 1815 to 1848, this is a period of the concert of Europe, it was called, of great power collaboration. Right? They manage their conflicts. They avoid wars with each other. very different than the second half of the century, the period that's ushered in by the revolutions of 1848. Second half of the century, what do you find? Well, you have the Crimean War from 1854 to 1856, the Franco-Austrian War in 1859, the war, the three wars of German unification, the war with Denmark in 1864, the Austro-Prussian War in 1866, the Franco-Prussian War in 1870-1871, you know, and on it goes. This is not to mention the fact that there are all kinds of crises between the great powers that, that you know, almost lead to war, great Near Eastern crisis of 1875-1878, another Near Eastern crisis in 1887. Right? This is Europe's in hot water during this period. Very, very different. No concept of Europe anymore. Now they're all at odds with each other. Right? Now there's that basic fact of that stunning change from the first half of the century to the second. What light does it shed on the issue that we're concerned with in this class? A lot of light. Right? You can see why right away. You can't blame that change on the system. Not the system as Waltz and people like that define it. It's the same system. You have sovereign states in the second half of the century, but you also had sovereign states in the first half of the century. No overarching authority in either period. The structure of the system is the same. It's still the same anarchic system. Right? No universal empire. Right? So, you know, historians have this expression, you can't explain a change by a constant. The system is basically the same system, a system of great powers, sovereign states. You can't explain why, simply by referring to the system, why the first half of the century is peaceful and the second half is much more warlike. Right? It must have to do with things other than the system. It must have to do, I don't know, with the personalities of states, the particular policies that they pursue. And in fact, as one of the indicators, if not the causes of this difference between the two halves of the century, is that the statesmen are by and large rather different. I mean, just compare Metternich with Bismarck, the dominant figure in the latter half of the century. You know, Metternich said, for me, Europe has the quality of a homeland. Whereas for Bismarck, he was like utterly contemptuous of the idea of Europe. You know, for him, it's like when statesmen were too embarrassed to talk in terms of their own national interests, they would talk about Europe, right? But for him, Europe, he just wrote in the margin of a dispatch that he received, he said, Europe, a geographical expression. All this talk about the interest of Europe as a whole, this was just a lot of, you know, BS as far as Bismarck is concerned. A very different mentality. Right? Cause of the change or an indicator. You look in terms of events like the revolutions of 1848 and the type of people or Russian. You look in terms of the kinds of ideologies that came into play in the latter period as opposed to the former. There's a lot going on that could help you understand why these changes took place. But for our purposes, we don't want to just leave it at that and say, well, the mere contrast between the two halves of the century shows that there are big problems with that systemic interpretation, with the Waltz interpretation, the structural interpretation. We want to push the analysis a little deeper. Because one of the big issues is, well, maybe the first half of the century is a bit of an anomaly. You know, it's like, well, this is not normal international politics, you could argue. Second half of the century really corresponds to what international politics is really about. It's much more natural, much more normal. You could argue. So to kind of get at that whole issue, we want to look at the whole at the question of how rational the various policies pursued by statesmen in that period were. Are they to be understood in rational terms? Are they rational in the sense of corresponding to the basic logic of the system? The system creates certain incentives. The system pushes and shoves, Walt says. The system creates certain imperatives, right? Are the policies pursued by statesmen rational in terms of the incentives that are created by the system in which they found themselves? Because if they were, and if those policies led to international conflict, you could say, well, yeah, there's something to that point of view. There's something to that Walt's argument. The system really is to blame. But if not, it really forces you to rethink that whole set of questions. And in fact, you want to push it a little bit beyond that by saying, well, in all these different cases, the case of the 1850s, 1860s, whatever, if statesmen had thought in rational power political terms, if they had thought in terms of what sort of policies would provide for the security of their own countries, not in terms of the interests of Europe as a whole, but just in terms of their own narrow, parochial national interests, what sorts of policies would they have pursued? And would those policies have led to a stable or to an unstable international system? You know, a thought experiment, but based on the specifics of the particular cases involved. Okay, so that's what we want to do. That whole way of looking at things serves simply as a framework for bringing the issues into focus, the questions into focus, so that we could then draw meaning from the historical record. Okay. So this is kind of methodologically, this is like the basic premise of the course, that you gotta pull together the empirical side and the conceptual side. The empirical stuff by itself, the kind of straight history, it's like it doesn't speak on its own, right? It has to be made to speak by posing questions derived from the theoretical literature, from an attempt to kind of grapple with these issues at a certain level of abstraction, level of generality. You want to avoid both extremes of the kind of mindless empiricism of a lot of historical work that doesn't bring out what's important in what you're looking at, with the kind of excessively abstract quality of a lot of international relations thinking, which doesn't tie these general arguments to what's going on in the real world. You want to pull these things together. So that's what we want to do in the course, and that's what I want to try and do a little bit today. Okay. So we have this great issue, and we're struck by the fact that international politics in the two parts of the century, very different. Before 1848, concert of Europe, the second half of the century, much more self-assertive, much more conflictual. Right? And the question is, why? Is it because of the system? Is it because of sovereign states? Because of all these different countries acting rationally in terms of the imperatives of the system? Or is it something else? Maybe it's because they behave irrationally. And if they behaved rationally, maybe you would have had a much more peaceful world. Who knows? Well, those are our questions. We don't know the answers quite at this point. Okay. And so our problem is, how do you understand the change? What caused the change? And always when you find a change that's so striking, you look to the chronology. And there was this great event or set of events that characterized this pivotal period. This is the revolutions of 1848 and their consequences, their implications. I'm not going to go through the details of the revolutions. The Rich book is very good on this. this stuff. He tells you everything you need to know about revolution in France that overthrew the kind of bourgeois monarchy of Louis Philippe and ushered in the Second Republic, which soon became a dictatorship of Louis Napoleon Bonaparte, the nephew of the great Napoleon. And then 3 years later, Louis Napoleon, after having seized power and made himself a dictator, proclaimed himself Emperor of the French. And he took the title Napoleon III. And how the revolution in France kind of triggered revolutions throughout Central Europe, in Germany, in Italy, in the Austrian Empire. Hungarians rose up. They had to be put down by an intervention of Russia. Russian armies invaded Hungary. In Italy, the Italian revolutions were put down by the Austrians. In Germany, there was an attempt to kind of create a liberal, unified German state at the Frankfurt Parliament. Frankfurt Parliament didn't have any real power, and that was eventually put down. And so you basically have a return to the status quo. These regimes, none of in Central Europe, or Austria and Germany and Italy, were restored. They were not overthrown. In France, you have, of course, an important change of regime. The revolutions of 1848 responsible for the shift we're talking about. And at a certain level, you say, well, it shouldn't have had that effect. When you look back at the Concert of Europe, one of the great tactics of the Concert of Europe was the idea that the established order was threatened by revolution. And the conservative regimes that had defeated Napoleon, they had to stick together so that they would be able to put down the forces of revolution, domestically or even beyond their borders. That was an important taproot of the Concert of Europe. Well, wouldn't you expect the revolutions of 1848 to have injected new life into that whole way of thinking? Right? Wouldn't you have expected all these conservative regimes to say, well, maybe we had let down our guard a little bit too much. We gotta, maintain our solidarity because the threat of revolution is very real. But you don't find something like that. Why? Because a whole second set of factors enters into play that's actually much more important. And this is this whole notion of what do the revolutions of 1848 reveal? They reveal something about the force, not so much of liberalism, but of nationalism, national feeling. In Italy, it's like part of a Italian nationalists who want to kind of get the Austrians out. In Germany, part of nationalists who want to create a unified German state. Right? Part of Hungary, these are nationalistic people who want to kind of seize for the Hungarians control over their own destiny, and for that matter, over the Slavic minorities that live within what they view as the borders of Hungary. They reveal something about the power of nationalism. And that has its effect on the international situation, above all in Germany. Because, especially in Prussia, you've seen this during the period of the Napoleonic Wars, you see it again. The Prussian government, which is essentially a government based on the Junkers, they've called the landowning class of the very eastern part of Prussia, east of the Elbe River. These were conservative people worried about the threat of revolution. How do you deal with the threat of revolution? Just by opposing it? Well, they said, no, this is a extremely powerful tide. You could see the power. It was reflected in what happened in 1848. Instead of fighting it, you want to exploit it. This is a tide that you should ride. You should take advantage of it. You should harness the forces of German nationalism to the interests of the Prussian state. Right? That's the way that Prussia could develop her power. Right? So you find Prussia moving in that direction. So taking advantage of German nationalism. And in a sense, for Prussia to take the lead had a lot of appeal to the more nationalistic people in Germany. There are two great alternative ways of solving the German problem in the view of people at that time. One was called the small German solution, the Kleindeutsch solution was called, which basically meant excluding Austria, Germany, including Prussia and the other areas in North Germany, but also the intermediate states in what's now the southern part of Germany, Bavaria, Baden, Württemberg, right? But excluding Austria, the German, because Austria had a lot of German-speaking people, and what's now the Republic of Austria, but also throughout Bohemia and Moravia, and scattered throughout the Austrian monarchy. These people were out, according to the Kleindeutsch solution, because you didn't want so many non-German people in the Austrian Empire. You have a solution, the Grossdeutsch solution, that includes Austria. You no longer have an ethnically homogeneous, a more or less homogeneous German state. And if you're going to have the Kleindeutsch solution, Prussia is the obvious leader. And a lot of liberals kind of put their liberalism aside and for nationalistic reasons were willing to accept the leadership of Prussia. This created enormous incentives for the Prussian state to take advantage of this. And in fact, there was a time in 1850 when the Prussians seemed ready to kind of move ahead with this. To the point where the Austrian government, once it had consolidated its power, basically forced the Prussians to draw back. Prussia was kind of isolated in Europe, did not have support of other countries. Russia basically was on Austria's side. And the Prussian government was forced to backtrack by making an agreement at the town of Olmütz. German nationalists would refer to it years later as the humiliation of Olmütz, in which they agreed to undo what they had done in terms of their proposals for the unification of northern Germany. Okay, right away you can see that this is no longer the world of the concert of Europe. One of the key features of the post-1815 world was the German Confederation and the idea that Austria and Prussia, the two great German states, would cooperate with each other, run Germany on a bilateral basis. And now they're at odds. Austria split off from Germany. The rise of national sentiment has a terrible effect on the position of Austria. Austria, this multinational empire. You know, you have Germans and Hungarians and Czechs and Slovaks and Ruthenians and Serbs and Croats and Slovenians and Romanians, and just kind of goes on and on. Multinational empire in an age of nationalism, this is a source of weakness. Not just in internal terms, but in terms of the support that Austria had gotten from abroad. You recall one of the elements of the 1815 system was that Austria, precisely because she was a saturated country, didn't want any more, especially non-German populations. Austria was very happy with the status quo. So other states that were happy with the status quo would support Austria, and that was a source of strength for Austria. Austria would throw her weight into the balance, a weight enhanced by the support she was getting from other countries, like the Britain of Castlereagh, on behalf of the status quo. So this was a source of stability. This is what people meant when they said that Austria was a European necessity. Okay? But when you have nationalism taking hold, not just in Germany, Italy, and getting sympathy, increasing sympathy in the West, by the West I mean France and Britain, then that's bound to affect the nature of the relations of those countries with Austria. Right? And with the rise of nationalism, even within Slavic populations of Southeastern Europe, it's kind of natural, as nationalistic ideas spread, that within Russia there will be a natural sympathy for Russia's fellow Slavs in Southeastern Europe, which is, you know, a recipe for trouble, because the Russians will want to extend their influence there on behalf of the Slavs, as well as on behalf of Russia's own national interests. Austria will feel encircled by Russian power. The Slavic nationalities within the Austrian Empire would be encouraged by that shift in the balance. Could lead to the destruction of Austria. Austria's in bad shape as a result of all these things. As I say, Britain and France. Napoleon III, what's his political program? Insofar as he has a political program at all, aside from the glory and greatness of France and of his own regime, he has an interest in national self-determination and reorganizing Europe on the basis of nationality. Sympathetic with Italian nationalism, at least within certain limits. Sympathetic with German nationalism, at least within certain limits. Right? Here you have a problem, right? Is it really to France's interest to see strong national states come into being on her borders? Is it in France's interest to see, you know, not just strong Italy, in terms of never to have been a real problem for anybody, but a strong Germany, which was a very serious problem? Which way are you going to go? You know, you have to have a clear policy, a coherent policy, but if you pulled in these two directions, favoring Germany because all of your liberal instincts and your belief in nationality suggest that the Germans should have a national state, but also realizing that a German national state, a strong state, right on France's eastern border, well, that this would limit French power. You know, doesn't quite square that particular circle. But the general effect of the rise of nationalism, especially, is that the concept of liberal power, liberal power, Britain, or society is going to be in France, society is going to be in and you have the power to push your ideological force. Well, that's going to be at the expense of more conservative countries. The rise of that kind of liberal foreign policy, a policy that took its distance from these policies based on our political interests, right? That's inevitably a source of instability. That inevitably creates problems. This is an important point. We'll see this point when I think that they're trying to mean order in a minute. But, you know, we like to think rise of democracy, rise of liberalism, this goes hand in hand with a more peaceful international order. It doesn't necessarily work that way. You know, it's like you'd like to think that this is true. You'd like to think that the alternative view of policies based on hard calculations of power, political interest,
That's not the way to go. You should embrace the moral principle. You should try and extend liberty and democracy in the world. And then automatically, the moral policy will also lead to a peaceful world. You see, one of the important lessons of this period is the 19th century. All things are by no means that simple. Oh, thanks.
Okay. Okay. How is it possible for countries like Britain and France to pursue these very assertive policies? Standing up for the promotion of liberty, certainly not in the world as a whole, but at least in Europe. The British government to French government to embrace the cause, especially of, Italian independence, Italian unification. No one made it possible. One thing and one thing only. Remember those tables that you looked at last week? That table one, the table of the distribution of world manufacturing output. You can't understand any of this stuff unless you keep those figures in mind. You have this war, the Crimean War. And you'll see how Palmerston, especially one of the makers of British foreign policy during this period, had these extravagant war aims. Really, the destruction of Russian power, the undoing of like a century of Russian expansion, giving southern Russia back to the Turks. How could they contemplate something like this? 20th century, no one in their right mind would think of Britain or France conducting a military operation to bring about a rollback of Russian territorial expansion of that sort. Why were they able to do it? Because the basis of power had shifted in the course of the century as a result of the uneven development of the Industrial Revolution. The beginning of the century, world manufacturing output, Britain and France together was only slightly greater than that of Russia. Manufacturing in those days meant mostly small-scale manufacturing. But with industrialization, that changed. By the middle of the century, I think you had a figure for 1860, Britain and France together produced almost four times as much as Russia. Why are the figures about manufacturing output so important? Because this is the measure, ultimately, of what you're capable of generating in terms of military power. Your economic surplus can be translated into military power, especially with the industrialization of warfare and the increasing importance of steel in the production of guns, and ships and so on. Look at the figures for steel production. Russia's nothing in the middle of the century. Britain is by far the world's premier industrial power. And you have this theory, again, associated with Waltz, that when countries become really strong, that when power is unbalanced, then the strong countries are in a position to give free play to their ideological instincts, whatever they are. They could be liberal and democratic, or they could be, authoritarian or whatever. But when you have the strength, you're going to use it in behalf of your ideology. Right? It's only a balanced system that prevents foreign policies from getting that kind of ideological edge. Okay. All right, so the revolutions of 1848 usher in this new world, new spirit, much more self-assertive, nationalistic feelings, much more important. Countries a lot less interested in cooperation for its own sake. And you see this not so much in the case of the conservative powers of Eastern and Central Europe, as in the case of Britain and France, a change which has to be understood in terms of the shift in the basis of power in favor of the Western countries during this period. They pursue assertive policies. And this is most striking in the run-up to the Crimean War. The issue really begins in 1850, very early on. Goes again. How is the Crimean War to be understood? As an attempt to deal with the menace of Russian expansion, rooted in an attempt to contain Russian power? No. It was the French, basically, who decided to trigger the crisis. Again, these are very important points. Because you would like to think that these reactionary regimes are the source of all the problems. It was the more advanced regimes, the more liberal regimes, that were pursuing the more aggressive policies. This Norman Rich book, his chapter on this stuff, it's terrific. Rich himself wrote a whole book on the Crimean War. And he really knows what he's talking about here. And he gives you some just absolutely extraordinary evidence. He, for example, on page 107, he quotes Napoleon III's foreign minister. You know, the whole issue, the problem began with the French raising the question of the custodianship over the Christian holy places in the Ottoman Empire, in the Holy Land, in Palestine. And he says, the question of the holy places and everything affecting them was of no importance whatever to France. Tells a friend of his. All this Eastern question, which provoked so much noise, was nothing more for the imperial government than a means of dislocating the continental alliance which had tended to paralyze France for almost half a century. When finally an opportunity presented itself to provoke discord within this powerful coalition, the Emperor Napoleon immediately seized it. Then he goes on to quote Napoleon III himself. In March 1856, he informs his ministers that in order to dismantle the treaties concluded after the Napoleonic Wars, it had been necessary to separate Austria and Russia, which were always ready to menace us with the European coalition which deprived us of all our liberty. That was the great objective of the war, to separate the two powers and to regain for France its freedom of action. All right? They want to break the concert of Europe. You have to ask yourself, is this policy to be understood in rational political terms? What's the objection to the way France was treated in 1815? The settlement of 1815 was a very moderate settlement. France's freedom of action to do what? To intervene in Spain without getting the okay from the other countries of Europe? What's the advantage of that? Whereas a system that, in principle, constrains France, constrains everyone else as well. If you're concerned with the security of France, don't you want to live in a system where, as a matter of course, everyone will consult with you about the way all these different European issues would be resolved? Yeah. Doesn't it make sense to have a system that constrains everyone else as well? You see this attempt to kind of break the system without really thinking through the consequences. So it's though, well, you know, France had been defeated in 1815. The victor powers imposed this peace. By virtue of that fact, that 1815 settlement was imposed on a France that had been defeated. That settlement is bad. We got to get rid of it. We got to break the concert of Europe. We got to divide Austria from Russia. Right? You weaken Austria, that increases Russian power. Is that to your interest? Is it to your interest to weaken Austria, a bulwark of the status quo? No, these things, They don't think through these things in a serious power political way. The breaking of the concert system is considered desirable as an end in itself. Plus, they want a military operation in order to contribute to the prestige of the imperial regime. Right? It's like very un-Clausewitz-y. You know who Clausewitz was? He's the great Prussian theorist of war from the Napoleonic, post-Napoleonic period. The most important theorist of war that has ever existed. And the basic insight of Clausewitz is you can't think of war in its own terms. War has to be understood in political terms. Whether you use military force or not, that's a political decision. You should always think in terms of whether it's in your political interest to do so. Right? If you just go to war for the sake of glory, that's crazy. Right? Doesn't contribute to your national interest, not to be understood in rational terms. And yet you have that touch of irrationality made possible by the fact that the economic balance has shifted to the West during this period.
Okay.
All right, so the French pursue this provocative policy on raising the issue of the Holy Land, the Christian sites in the Holy Land, and getting the Turks to kind of give France these rights, right? Most of the Christians in the Ottoman Empire, and a lot of them, are of the Orthodox rite, very few Roman Catholics there. And the Ottomans are delighted to be able to do this because they like the idea of bringing France into play to counterbalance Russian power, right? If France and Russia are at odds, then the Ottomans can gain. They'll be able to kind of play them off against each other. And the Russians rise to the bait. They allow themselves to be provoked. They send a mission under an important Russian figure, General Menshikov, to Constantinople in early 1853, to also make demands on the Turks. The Turks have no interest in acceding, right? Because they want to create trouble with Russia, because they sense that this will bring the Western powers into play against Russia. And so the Menshikov mission fails, and the Russians respond by occupying what's now Romania, these two principalities of Moldavia and Wallachia. You know, saying, we're going to seize this as a guarantee to make sure the Turks negotiate seriously with us on this issue. Right? So it allows us to be provoked. And one thing leads to another. The British and French send fleets to Turkey as a show of force, and it's evidence of their determination to back up the Turks in this whole area. The Turks declare war on Russia. The Russians respond by destroying a Turkish fleet in the town of Sinope in the Black Sea, creating great outrage in the West, although these two countries are at war. Austria, all this stuff puts Austria in a terrible bind. What's Austria to do? The whole essence of Austrian policy had been to try and get the great powers to work together, and now they're at each other's throat. Should they side with Russia and alienate the Western powers? Well, they're vulnerable to the Western powers, especially in Italy. And the Italians still have important possessions, direct possessions even, in northern Italy. In Lombardy and Venetia, very important areas in Italy. Should they side with the Western powers against Russia? Well, they're worried about the expansion of Russian power. But if they go to war against Russia, the facts of geography would mean that Austria is going to have to do the bulk of the fighting. And then what would happen if the Western powers withdrew after the war and then... and then left Austria alone to face an aggrieved Russia. So Austrians are unable to prevent the war and trying to engineer a solution that everyone could live with, because the attempts at a settlement are basically sabotaged by important elements within the British and French governments. And Britain and France go to war against Russia in 1854. But this is not the end of the problem for Austria. Austria tries to engineer a modest settlement based on limited war aims. And the Austrians adopt a very active policy in an attempt to do this. They threaten the Russians that they might go to war on the anti-Russian side unless the Russians agree to moderate peace terms, but by being willing in principle to enter the war on the anti-Russian side, this gives them some leverage over Britain and France, also to say, you know, we'll come into the war if you also agree to moderate peace terms. So in that way, the whole idea is they'll pull both sides together. But this is a very risky strategy. They're sticking their necks out in a big way, alienating both sides. You know, Crimean War, regardless of the outcome, Crimean War necessarily resulted in a yet further weakening of the Austrian position. Important for the stability of Europe, because Austria is a bulwark of European stability. Okay. Why do these efforts fail until the very end? Wasn't as though there weren't important elements in Britain and France, especially Britain, that wanted a cautious policy, moderate policy. But they're undercut. There's all this enthusiasm for the war, all this anti-Russian fervor. Now, this is an important point for our purposes. You saw that remarkable passage in Rich, where he quotes Palmerston talking about Britain's war aims and rolling back all of these Russian conquests and giving Finland back to Sweden and so on. So an agenda of that sort, the total crushing of Russian power. Not only would that poison relations between Russia and the Western powers if it were successful for ages, but it's how are you going to do it? This huge country, Russia, how are you going to force them to give this stuff, you know, back? You know, can Britain and France occupy all of Russia? It's insane. How is this to be understood? If you know what I say is correct, the only reason they could even contemplate something like this is that these economic developments had given the Western powers such an enormous edge over Russia in terms of power. But if that's the case, what do they have anything to fear about? If they're so strong, where's the threat? The only way of squaring that circle is by saying, well, yeah, they're weak today, but they're going to be strong tomorrow. So let's take advantage of our edge and power that we have today in order to smash them so we're not going to have to worry about them tomorrow. Important, because that's what we call a preventive war argument. That sort of thinking plays much more of a role in the conduct of policy than you might imagine. All right. Anyway, the upshot, very, very quickly. What's the post-Crimean world look like? Traditional argument is very straightforward. Crimean War broke the concert of Europe. Right? True enough, but it's also another way of looking at it is to say that the Crimean War registered the fact that the concert of Europe had already been broken, that this was a very new world. And you have a totally different system now. Relations between Austria and Russia are poisoned. Between Austria and the Western powers aren't very good. Austria isolated. Whereas Prussia, not bad relations with Russia. Prussia had stayed out of all of this. Prussia got benefited from the sympathy of France on the nationalities question. The chief importance of all of this is that the path is now open for Prussia to pursue a much more active policy in the German question. Right? If you want to understand why the German question comes alive, it's not simply Bismarck coming to power in Germany. There are changes in the structure of the system that make all this possible. And that's what I'm going to be talking about next time, unification of Germany in 1860s.